Greetings, everyone. I'm James Dobson, and I want to talk to you today about a very delicate topic which is rarely discussed in Christian circles, and yet it really needs to be faced squarely and openly. By that, I'm referring to the lure of infidelity, which is so pervasive in our highly eroticized society today. How subtle are the forces that draw people together in an illicit relationship, and how tragic are the consequences after it occurs. Let's dare, then, to examine this important topic in an atmosphere of candidness and concern during the program which follows.
Our topic for today's program, Dr. Dobson, is a very serious one, dealing with extramarital affairs and the inevitable consequences that result from them. Now, obviously, you wouldn't have selected this subject today if you didn't believe the problem of marital cheating wasn't rather widespread, would you?
No, I wouldn't, Flo, but it really doesn't take a sociologist or a psychologist to make that kind of observation today. Even a child could make that observation, because we're absolutely saturated in sexuality at this time in our culture. I think it's important to understand that sexual stimulation is not a constant from culture to culture and from time to time. It's a variable. It changes. It changes with cultural mores and what's going on in a culture. There are times in a given society where sexuality is relatively quiet, and there are other times, like at this time in the Western culture, when it is everywhere. It is on everybody's minds. Everybody is talking about it. Everybody's thinking about it. It's on the billboards. It's in the movies. You can't get away from it in the movies. It's on television. You can hardly get away from it there, even if you pick your programs. Because if it's not included in the content of the program, it is used to sell the commercials that pay for the program. It's in all literature. It's on the covers of not only magazines, but covers of newspapers now. Sexuality is everywhere in our culture, very much out in the open at this time. And along with this tremendous emphasis has come a proportional increase in infidelity and marital cheating. And it has provided the substance for drama and for the kind of things I was mentioning just now. I have in my hand an advertisement for the television program MASH, which seems to concentrate on that subject of infidelity rather regularly. And this is what they said about a particular program that aired a while back. If Henry's feet seem to be planted firmly in the clouds, it's because he's just returned from Tokyo, heels over head in love with a girl just half the age of his wife. Now, isn't that hilarious? At the time that this was shown in my city, there was another program going on in another channel where Carlton Heston was having an affair with somebody else in a different setting, in a different manner. And you can hardly turn on the television set today without seeing that emphasis in some manner or another. And one of the greatest tragedies, you see, in marital life is for one partner who loves and needs another one as God intended, wanting to become one flesh with another person, entering into that lifetime union and commitment, to be rejected and thrown over and disregarded for the want of someone younger or someone else who is available. That's a tremendous tragedy. What that does to the one left behind will never be forgotten. The life will never be the same. The scars will go with that person to their grave. Self-esteem is always assassinated in that kind of situation, and yet it's become the subject for great humor. This message of infidelity has been sold to the American people, and far too many of us, an increasing number of us, has bought that message, and we believe it, and are trying to live it with all those consequences.
That's really frightening. Have you found in your counseling practice that Christians are being caught in the same trap?
It's extremely naive, I think, to believe that those who call themselves Christians are not affected by this characteristic of our times as well. Outside of hunger, the most powerful of all human urges and drives is the sexual appetite. It's there. It has an influence on us. Christians have the same biochemical forces within their bodies that non-Christians do. And I find that Satan can sometimes make use of this tool and this weapon against us when others do not work, because he intertwines in it our own emotional needs for love and acceptance and belonging and caring and tenderness. And the trap is laid, and we're falling into it in many cases, just like those outside the Christian community.
I wonder, Dr. Dobson, do most men at some point in their marriages have extramarital desires?
Well, a Christian husband is given a great responsibility to control those desires and passions. Jesus said in Matthew 5:28, "He that looketh on the body of a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her in his heart already." In other words, this scripture reveals Jesus' awareness that this kind of visual lust, particularly, is a very real threat and a considerable danger to be guarded against by men. But I saw a statement not too long ago in Psychology Today, which said, and I quote, "All men, A-L-L, all men, from the first day of their marriages onward, think about this possibility of infidelity. Not that they plan to do something about it necessarily, but the possibility is a conscious thing in their minds." Now, that may be a frightening statement, and it may even be an overstatement, I'm not sure. But Flo is not far from right because of this biochemical influence that's there. At least the possibility is there for, let's say, most men from early within marriage.
That would have been the case 10 years ago or 15 years ago, according to that. But then with the stimulation today, it would make it more likely.
Sure. What's different today is all kinds of people in authority saying, don't fight it. Don't resist it. It's a good thing. You're going to like this. Come on. Try it. Besides that, you ought to be looking out for old number one anyway.
Perhaps, Dr. Dobson, it would be helpful to know how infidelity usually begins and how we can guard against this satanic trap.
Flo, I'm going to ask our listener friend to imagine a straight line drawn from left to right across a blackboard or on a sheet of paper, and let that line represent the straight and narrow path of responsibility. Just one straight line. And underneath that line, imagine the words, straight life. Now, what does a straight life really consist of? It means, in very practical, everyday kind of terms, caring for children, paying your bills, changing diapers, cleaning the house, washing dishes, getting up in the morning and going to work, carrying your responsibilities in life. On Sunday, instead of lying in bed and listening to an NFL game or reading the newspaper, it's getting up and going to church. It's having your devotions together as a family. It's giving, giving, giving. It's perhaps working 50 weeks out of the year and having 2 weeks vacation and perhaps giving that to the children. It is being what other people need you to be, and it's doing the responsible thing. And to be very honest with you, the straight life for all of us eventually gets heavy. There are times for nearly everyone when that matter of working, 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 doing what's right, doing what God wants you to do, doing what others need, subjecting your own needs, there are times when all of that gets very heavy. And times when most people ask, what's it all about, Alfie? You know, is this what life's all about? And for all of us that are on this straight life, there are other voices which are calling us off it. We've already talked about them earlier in this program. You don't have to look far to find them. I mean, they'll come in through the door. They'll come underneath the door. They come in through the television set. Those other voices enticing you off the straight life. What are some of those voices? One of them is the voice of pleasure. Women are most commonly drawn off the straight life and into an illicit relationship. If it's going to happen, it's usually at this level for romantic kinds of involvement. It's staying at home, wishing somebody cared, wishing somebody needed me, wishing that I had some kind of excitement in my life, and along comes somebody who offers that, some enchanted evening across a crowded room, you know, and they're lured off the straight life and into a romantic and illicit affair. Sex itself, sex in terms of the sexual experience, intercourse, I suppose gets the credit for luring some people off the straight life. But to be very honest with you, I think it ranks fairly low as a reason for people leaving the straight life. If you have to put all of the voices in rank order, this one ranks pretty low. If a person wants that, I suppose he can find it with a prostitute. Of far greater significance, and probably the most important and most dynamic voice luring people off the straight line, is one we haven't even mentioned yet. And by that I'm referring to that old bugaboo of ego needs, of the fact that I don't like myself very well, and along comes somebody who seems to respect me, still thinks I'm attractive, still thinks that I have something to offer, finds me exciting, finds me intellectually stimulating, flatters my ego. Oh my, this is the one that traps people. For both men and women, it's usually involved in all the other voices one way or another. It shows the wisdom of Solomon, again, writing in the 7th chapter of Proverbs, where he was describing a young man who was about to get involved with another man's wife, although he called her a prostitute. And her husband was going out of town, and this young man was following her down the road to destruction. And Solomon put the motives in proper perspective there when he said, it was really not her sexual involvement that was enticing him. It was that he could not withstand her flattery. See, that's the key word. She flattered him. It was his ego that hooked him. And I see that as probably the most powerful tool that Satan has to get people involved in extramarital affairs and practically every other kind of sin as well, because the ego is the core of the personality. And it provides so much motivation for what we do. And that temptation is always out there, Flo, and it's beckoning and calling. Just as Satan did to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. You know, what did he say to Eve? Come on, this is good. You're going to like this. This is going to make you wise. This is a good thing. God said don't do it, but what does he know? This is something he just doesn't want you to enjoy. So don't be denied this pleasure. Come on. And he enticed her and he pulled her into it. And before she knew it, she had broken in fellowship with God. I see this happening in my counseling experience over and over, Flo, where people have yielded to one of these voices and gone off the straight life and into disaster as a result.
Well, do people just suddenly deviate from the life of commitment and responsibility?
It may appear that way to those who are standing on the outside watching, those who don't know what the real motives are. But when you're on the inside of the story and when you know what's really been going on behind people's eyes and between their ears, it usually is not a sudden thing at all. What happens first is that great needs arise. You see, the greater the needs for pleasure, romanticism, sex, and ego needs, the greater the needs within marriage, the louder these voices scream. So we begin with a need that accumulates and is not being met. And the person is usually crying to others around them, meet my needs, hear me, love me, understand me, care for me. And these cries are not heard or understood or responded to. That's the beginning stage. Then the next stage is for the person to take not a great deviation from the straight life, but just a little blip off of it. It's a lunch with a secretary that may last just a little bit too long. And he could explain it. It's no big deal. Goodness, we were only there an hour, and we were talking about business most of the time. Perfectly innocent, but both of them know that it was a flirtation. Mm-hmm. Then you come back to the straight life and you evaluate. And then another blip occurs, and this one takes you a little further out. And you're being lured. That's why I call it the lure of infidelity. You're lured off that straight life. And it goes farther and further. And then I find that most people who eventually get into infidelity know a moment when they said to themselves, yes, I'm going to do it. And that moment usually occurs before they actually get into the illicit affair. It may occur a week or two before. It may occur an hour before. But there is a moment of yielding, saying, yes, I will. And that is a disastrous moment in the life, certainly in the life of a marriage.
What happens then? Do they find what they're seeking?
Perhaps they do for a short time, Flo, but an incredible thing always occurs. And I'll underline the word always there, which is dangerous in any kind of behavior, but I found it to be invariably true. They eventually establish another straight life. You chase after romanticism. You don't keep that kind of romantic fire forever. You don't keep that great sexual intrigue or these ego needs being met. Eventually, you come to another straight life. You've eventually returned to responsibility, I would hope. And what happens when that straight life gets heavy? See, you're back to responsibility. The grass is greener on the other side of the fence, but it still has to be mowed.
Yes.
And so you come back to that everyday routine kind of thing. And then what happens when your needs start screaming again? And I know people, and you do too, who careen down the road to old age. jumping from one straight life to another in the pursuit of some kind of excellence, who knows what, leaving in their wake broken marriages, broken people, broken little children who don't know who their father is or their mother is, who don't know why they left and why they're not here to love me and not here to meet my needs. And then as they grow up, they've had a model and they've had a pattern to perpetuate in their own families, and it just reverberates generation after generation.
You've talked about the tragic implications for the one who's left behind as the result of an illicit relationship, Dr. Dobson. What are some of the other consequences of leaving the straight life?
Well, I referred kind of indirectly a moment ago to the consequences for children who are involved, and of course that's my major interest and concern. I can't tell you, Flo. There's no way to describe to you what I've observed on this level, and I'm not trying to heap guilt on people, but children are so vulnerable to what their parents do, and nothing that's done in the home escapes them. Everything leaves its impact on them. Flo, there is still no substitute for the prescription that God gave us for the family. His values and His principles are right, and they work, and you can count on them, and you can believe them. And when He says, don't do this, He says it not to deprive us of pleasure, and not to prevent us from having our share of the excitement and warmth in this life. He does it to spare us the consequences of this kind of behavior. And I just want to say to the person who's listening, if you are being drawn off the straight life, don't let it happen to you. You know what the solution is? We shouldn't spend our whole program talking about the problem. Let's talk about the solution. The solution to a happy marriage is to bring those voices into the straight life so that the straight life is not so heavy. To leave time in marriage for romanticism. To leave time in marriage for pleasure and enjoyment and walking along, being together and talking together and meeting each other's needs. And that brings a very natural involvement sexually, as God intended, as an expression of love between a husband and wife, to leave time for ego needs. Don't assassinate your spouse at parties, making fun of them and devaluing their self-esteem and self-worth. Pull their ego needs into the straight life. Meet those needs. That's what marriage was intended to do. And this is why I talk so much about the problem of fatigue and time pressure in our culture, where we're going separate directions. We're living together, we're at home, but we're not meeting each other's needs, and the needs get louder. And when the needs get greater, then the voices calling people off the straight life get greater. There's still no substitute for the system that God designed. And I was sitting in church, maybe this is a good place to conclude. I was sitting in church the other day, just a couple of weeks ago, and I had a thought that is nothing profound, but I picked up a piece of paper and I wrote this statement, and maybe it expresses kind of what I'm trying to say today. Movie producers often attempt to link a new film with a successful venture from the past. They shout with characteristic immodesty, "From the people who gave you Duel at Gunslinger's Ranch comes an epic picture of staggering proportions. John Wayne blows his cool." The motive, of course, is to use an earlier triumph as an endorsement for a subsequent production. Now, following that logic as applied to the concepts of marriage and parenthood, what a fantastic association can be made on behalf of the principles in which I believe. I proclaim it with unconcealed pride. From the Creator who gave you snow-capped mountains and towering oak trees and sunsets and fawns and fish and babies, and the sun and the moon and the stars and the planets. Alas, from the mind that produced the infinite wonders of the universe comes the ultimate prescription for harmonious living. It's called the family, and when it functions as intended, it reveals the love and wisdom of the Creator Himself. And I think that about says it all for me.
Thank you, Dr. Dobson.
Hello, I'm James Dobson. Well, our program today is addressed specifically to that person in our audience whose marriage may be in trouble, perhaps after years of frustration and conflict. And there are certainly millions of people like that within the sound of my voice. We want to speak directly to that individual who is considering the final step of divorce and anticipating the disintegration of marriage. With me in the studio today is a woman who's been that route, and she has some views of her own, some unique views that I think may be helpful to others. Mrs. Betty Rigdon is with me today. Betty, welcome to Focus on the Family.
Thank you, Jim.
It's a real pleasure to have you here, and you have a message that I feel needs to be heard far and loud in our country today, because divorce is being almost recommended as a solution to all the world's problems and all marital problems. There was a book not too long ago on the subject of creative divorce that made it sound like the beginning of everything wonderful and new. And you have come through a divorce, and I think it would be healthy for our listeners to know some of the things that you experienced in the process of that breakup. First of all, tell us a little bit about your present marriage and your present situation.
Okay. My husband, Eddie, and I have both been married before, as you said. Eddie was married for almost 12 years and was divorced about 5 years ago and has two children, of whom he has custody. Paul is now 12 and Ellen's almost 9. And I was divorced when my daughter was just a baby, and she's now 12 years old also. It was very difficult for Eddie and I both going through a divorce because it was not in our backgrounds, in our upbringing, in our church background to be divorced. So therefore, we had to struggle with that before we could even come to terms with a remarriage.
When you got married the first time, did you consider it for life?
I think I was probably too young to consider it much past the day of the wedding. My husband was also very young, and if we had the same situations to do over again, obviously it wouldn't be the same. But I think in the back of everybody's mind, marriage, just from looking at your families, is an institution there to stay.
You were raised in a Christian home, weren't
yes,
you?
Yes, I was.
And Eddie was also?
Yes, uh-huh.
Tell us some of the feelings and emotions that you had when your marriage started to go sour and how you perceived the end of your first marriage.
I think probably the worst part of going through a divorce is knowing that you have failed in something that is probably one of the most important endeavors you make in your whole life. To know that it just isn't working, and you're a big part of that.
It's probably your fault.
Oh.
Everybody internalizes that guilt.
Oh. Not only that, but I think probably the feelings that come after the divorce are really worse than the ones during the divorce. Unfortunately, everyone encourages you to get a divorce. They say, he wasn't good enough for you. You'll be better off next time. You'll find somebody else. He wasn't the right person for you anyway. And everyone likes to get involved in a soap opera, real life, right in front of them. But after a while, they're gone, and you're alone. And you're alone at night. The next day, you have to go to work. You may, as in most cases these days, have children. You have to take care of them yourself. Your car breaks down. Johnny gets the measles. No one cares. No one's there. Your friends are gone, your husband or wife is gone, and there you are, and you're all alone.
Betty, I don't want to become too personal or ask you to reveal things you'd rather not, but tell us what you feel comfortable in telling us about your first marriage and some of the problems that you faced.
Well, I was, as I said before, very young, and I think marriage, too many people who are, say, under the age of 20, is more or less like playing house. It's kind of a game. But when the game turns into something that's not very much fun, such as a case where you have one spouse that is unfaithful, and you know it, it
gets very painful.
Right,
it
really does. As I said before also, it was not in my upbringing to consider divorce, and yet I knew that in my own situation, the way things were, and with the fact of adultery there, that it really was the only way for us. There was no thought of trying to work it out between the two of us. There was just nothing there. And my husband had no desire to stay. And so, although it was a shock, it was, at the same time, a relief.
Now, you didn't have much choice in the matter then. It was not a matter of just deciding, well, we'll get a divorce. It was almost forced on you. But did you see divorce as a solution to your problems?
I think at that time I did. I didn't know anything else. But since then, throughout the years, had I been more mature at the time, I possibly could have seen another way. But unfortunately, people feel so desperate at the time when they're faced with something like that, they very rarely see another solution unless they've got someone to help them and to guide them.
How old were you when you went through this?
18.
You were 18 when you went through
yes.
the divorce, and you already had a baby?
Yes.
Wow. we could probably spend an hour or two talking about teenage marriage.
Oh, I made my daughter, when she was 4 years old, sign a contract saying she wouldn't get married until she was 25. A reminder of that all the time.
So you went into a period of loneliness and somewhat isolation, perhaps?
This probably is the one thing I would really like to say something about. I hear so many people talk about their freedom once they get divorced and how much fun it's going to be to get back into the swinging singles and into the dating life. And it's absolutely false, these hopes that they hold. Dating after you've been married is nothing like dating before you're married. It's a whole new ballgame with a whole new set of rules, particularly if you try to live morally. It's almost impossible. People say, you're divorced, you're young,
they expect certain things.
Oh, very definitely. It's difficult to find anyone who doesn't think that way, in the church or not. Unfortunately,
that's
true.
That's a sad commentary.
Oh, some of my worst experiences, I hate to say this, were from people that I have met through, quote, church affiliations. Also, if you do find someone that you fall in love with, it's very difficult, once you've been married, not to want to have a physical relationship. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, you know it. You know what it's all about. And to love someone and to keep it on top of the table is very, yeah. very difficult.
How long were you single?
Just about 8 years.
And then you met Eddie Rigdon.
Yes.
Tell me about that introduction.
Eddie had been separated for several months and, as I said, had his children. And I had not really been dating anybody specific. And we had a mutual friend who thought she'd like to try playing matchmaker. And so she got us together, and it worked out pretty good.
Now I know you're about to tell us that you got married and sailed off into the sunset and it solved all your problems and you never had another difficulty.
Right, absolutely,
right?
Sure.
You do have a happy marriage, though, don't you?
Yes. Eddie and I feel we're very lucky. We get along very well. He's my friend, and I'm his friend, and we just have lots of fun together. But we also realize at the same time that we don't have God's ideal for marriage. The Bible states that God made man for one woman and vice versa, and Eddie and I can't say that. Eddie and I aren't a first for each other. And while that's not terribly important to a lot of people in the world today, it makes a difference. Also, we'll never have the joy of having a child together. And there are a lot of things in my past that it's very difficult for Eddie to deal with. And there are things in his past, too. They say the past isn't supposed to be part of the present.
But it is.
But it sure is. And even though God has forgiven us of our mistakes and our sins, we still have to live with the consequences of those actions, and those consequences are very much a part of our marriage today.
Now, specifically, share with us, and this is one of the main reasons that I wanted you to be my guest today, Betty, because I've heard you say it before, and I think it's tremendous. Share with our listeners some of the frustrations of being in a second marriage with children from each of the former marriages and some of the things that you have had to cope with.
Well, let me start by saying that I love my stepchildren, and they love me most of the time. But I'm not their mother. I'm there all the time. I take them to school. I wash their clothes. I take them shopping. I bake cookies. I take them to the dentist, to the library. I'm always there. They don't call me mother. I'm Betty. They see their mother just enough to remind them that she's there. This is very hard because you feel like you're bending over backwards and you're doing your best. And I must add, too, this is the same with my daughter and my husband. Even though she does not see her father, Eddie is still her stepfather. A little less pressure, but still it's mm-hmm. the same situation. It's very hard when you're trying your best, but you know that you can never get that title of mother. It's frustrating.
It's not something you can work your way into.
No, you don't earn motherhood. No, you either are or you aren't.
You do, but not that
right.
way.
Right, you know. It's frustrating, especially when you're trying to be a strong parent and lay down rules. Eddie and I work very closely together with the discipline of our children. And yet, when he's not there and it's up to me, boy, I know that look. I don't have to listen to you. You're not really my mother. Or when you say something and they turn around and go to their father, well, you know. And I know this doesn't just happen in combined families. This happens in all families. But it's even more acute in this type of a situation because you're aware of it. You know that what's happening. And, of course, we all think our children are perfect and everyone else's children aren't as perfect. And this really should be. I mean, you should feel special things towards your own children. I mean, they are your flesh and blood.
How do you handle the matter of fairness between the kids? Mm-hmm. How do you keep from favoring your own child? Oh. That would be there'd be a tremendous pressure to do that.
That's very difficult. Before we were married, Eddie and I talked at great length about this because we knew that if this whole thing was going to work, we had to settle this first. And we realized that we had to commit ourselves to the idea that we were going to treat them equally. Even though we didn't feel equal, we had to let it on the surface appear that all three were equal, deserved the same amount of attention and discipline and the whole thing. Now, this doesn't always work out quite right. And sometimes there are bad feelings, but we keep trying. The biggest problem, of all of them. Well, I think you've all experienced when you have a problem with one of your children, when the mother and father sit down and talk about it, they can most of the time come up with a reasonable solution or way they're going to handle something. It's not always easy, but it's
workable.
Workable, right. However, when you bring in another parent or two, three or four sets of grandparents, an assortment of aunts and uncles and cousins, and a lot of well-meaning friends who knew you before and know you now, you're only asking for trouble. When a couple gets a divorce, it's obvious they had differences of opinion. And those opinions, those differences of opinion, do not fly out the window once you're divorced. In fact, they seem to multiply. This seems to be particularly true in the area of children. Everybody has their own idea of how children should be raised. And Eddie and I have very specific ways because of our church involvement. We're a very, very strong church family, and our whole family structure is based on this. However, this is not true with the other people involved with our life. And this causes a great deal of problems because what you feel is right is, in many cases, exactly the opposite of what another parent who doesn't live with these children feels that the way it should be. And recently, my stepson was in the hospital for a few days. And, of course, we were all there. There was a mother and a father and a stepmother and a grandmother and a few other people. And by the end of the second day, one of the nurses said, just who's who around here? You know, who's the mother and who does this? And, you know, what do you say? Well, this person over here, we all took numbers. And to top it all off, none of the adults were even talking to each other. And this poor kid just lying here in this bed wondering, you know, what's going on here? This is very difficult. Oh, it's very hard. And I hear people talk about being friends with their ex-husband or wife, and yet I've really never seen that in reality. I wonder if it really is such a thing. I think it would be very nice if adults could maintain a friendly relationship for the sake of the children, but I don't see too much of that either. And unfortunately, so much hostility and frustration and anger comes out over the children that wasn't released years before in a marriage, and the children really suffer from that. Because they don't know what's going on. They don't understand. They didn't understand the whole thing in the first place, let alone all this combination of input. It's just too much for children to understand.
The Bible talks about marriage making us one flesh, and if that's the case, when there's a disintegration of the relationship, there's necessarily a ripping and tearing of that flesh, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no way to make that a sweet little simple clean, nice break. I'm with you, Betty. I have seldom seen it happen with great friendliness and acceptance on all parts. It usually involves a great deal of strong emotion and a great deal of hurt, too.
Mm-hmm. Really, and as I said, children just aren't mature enough to handle this. And unfortunately, so many times, it comes out exactly the opposite of the way you would think. Children rebel. They get hostile. They just turn against everyone. Whereas what they're really trying to do is show everybody that they don't love daddy more than mommy or vice versa, and this is okay, but they can't express that. And it's very difficult for them to try and cope with their angry parents and stepmother and stepfather and grandparents. And it's
in a nutshell, you're saying, Betty, that divorce does not disentangle all of the families that are involved. The relationships continue even though the marriage disintegrates, doesn't it?
Very definitely. In fact, one of the most difficult things that Eddie and I have had to deal with, and I hope I can express this well, is the fact that even though my husband and his ex-wife have nothing between them now, there are still very strong bonds between them, started years ago with the birth of their children. He still cares for her as far as whatever happens to her is going to directly affect his children. Now, that's a very difficult thing for a present wife to deal with. We had some very close friends who have a similar situation that we do, and only this particular aspect is very, very outstanding in marriage, and it's almost as if he is catering to his ex-wife above his present wife, whereas he feels he is just looking out for her because of his children. That is something that, in the first place, is hard for a man to explain to the woman he now loves, that even though he no longer loves another woman the same way, he still cares for her.
Element of jealousy.
Oh.
There too, doesn't it?
And, you know, that's not something you can sit down and rationally sort out in your mind. But he's married to me. Why does he care about her? And what she did to him, there's just no
and
making that easy.
You alluded to a moment ago, I know, plays a big role. It's that other woman that remembers the youthful excitement of an early romance mm-hmm. and a first marriage and all of those kinds of memories and experiences they share that you don't.
Oh, absolutely. And I even have to be perfectly honest and say that there were feelings when I was very young for my first husband that I never, ever felt again, even though I love Eddie more and in better ways. There's just a certain thing that's gone.
That
I don't know if it's innocence or what. It is just
exuberance.
Something
mm-hmm.
that
There's
you just
no
never
trip
feel
like
again.
The first trip.
I'm very glad that you don't have to go through it again. But whatever it is, it's gone.
Betty, our time's almost gone, and you've beautifully stated some of the frustrations associated with where you've been. And the question comes up of where you're going. I'm sure you know that the probabilities for success of a second marriage are not as great as for a first marriage. What is going to happen between you and Eddie, and what does the future hold? I already know the answer to that, but I want you to share it with everybody else.
Eddie and I know that the world's odds against second marriage are not as great as the first. And I have to admit that sometimes in moments of frustration now that you think, why am I even here? Why did I do this? And yet, Eddie and I are very committed to our marriage. And we know that because our marriage is centered around Christ and He is the head of our home, this is the hope for our family now. Without that, we would have nothing. But because of that, our future is secure in His hands. And I also have to add that if Eddie and I have had this type of foundation in our first marriages, the chances of their success would have been much greater. Because that in this day and age, with the world being in the situation it is, I don't see how couples survive without Christ. The bestestest thing in my whole life is the fact that I did turn my life over to the Lord, and He made something out of a mess. And He gave me a life that I could never have gotten for myself.
Betty, in our final seconds, I'd just like to personalize what you've been saying for the benefit of the person who's listening that might be in the middle of that kind of mess that you were in at this moment. They don't know which way to turn. They're frustrated. They're exhausted. They're emotionally wrung out. And you have given the message very eloquently that divorce does not provide all the answers. And yet there in your final statement, I think you pointed us to the one who does have the final answers. We don't. I don't. I wish that I could wave a magic wand and solve all the marital problems in this country, and I can't do that. But I do know this, that God is the creator of marriage, that He cares about a relationship between husbands and wives because He ordained it. And if we can take hold of His power and His leadership and His influence, I think our probabilities for surviving the first one are much greater, and I'm sure you agree with that.